It's April 6th, year 2003. And that only means one thing, that we have our roundtable in place. They're all here, the first Sunday roundtable debate, politics. And it's April, it says here, let's talk politics. I don't know who wrote that. But anyway, everybody's accounted for except the Democrat. Why is that, Jim? Did you?
Perhaps just ashamed to show her face. I don't know. But we miss you. If you're out there listening, if you're driving in, Dana, please hurry.
Perhaps you detained her, Jim?
That's right. If only I had the power.
Yes. Well, let me introduce our panel of experts. Everybody's a panel of experts on this show. I don't know why. But anyway, our first Sunday roundtable panel includes...
Nick Sarwark, Libertarian.
Jim Parmalee, Republican.
Emily Loeffler, Independent.
Eric Michelson, Green.
Okay. And Democrats, you'll have to take up for your end. I'm sorry, your representative just didn't make it. Well, there are a lot of things to talk about. A lot of things to talk about. Let's start off with the affirmative action story. This past week at the University of Michigan and the Supreme Court, three white students sued, or they are suing the University of Michigan because they feel they've been discriminated against. What do you think will be the outcome of this particular case, which the Supreme Court is supposed to act on a lot of part of this summer?
Well, I think that the University of Michigan policy is going to be supported. I think that the students don't present a strong enough case here, and I think there's been a lot of high-power opposition to the case in the Supreme Court. So I think that until we see a better solution provided, affirmative action needs to stay in place.
Okay.
I don't know. Again, it seems like it could be a toss-up. From what I hear, it seems like O'Connor may be the swing vote on this one. A number of Republicans, or at least a couple of Republicans, have said that they would agree with a system where race counts for some amount in that calculation. The question is whether the 20 points that are awarded in the Michigan system is too large a percentage or not. So, again, it's going to be, sort of a nuanced decision on the part of the court, and I think it's going to be leaning towards supporting, but it's hard to say.
Nicholas, could there be a compromise?
There might be a compromise, but Jerry, I think that we really need to take a look at, obviously any private college can use whatever racial preferences they choose in admissions, but is it really fair to use public money to enforce racial preferences?
Okay, Jim.
And what the feds have done is they've expanded their regulation over colleges, because now they say that even if you accept federally funded scholarships, somehow you must be under everything the feds tell you to. So you've had some colleges that have refused to even accept federal scholarships. But I think the question here is discriminating on the basis of race permissible, or is it not? You can't go a little bit on it. Either you do or you don't. And the Supreme Court has to decide whether we do or don't.
Now, you said discriminating on the basis of race. If you took that term and turned it around as to what Condoleezza Rice was telling the president, and according to the Washington Post, she said that what? Race should be a factor.
There are a lot of opinions out there, but I think that we'll be better off as a society if we get to a colorblind society, and it's hard to do that when you have state-sponsored discrimination.
Is that true?
Well, I think that there are a lot of factors that go into college admissions. There are plenty of universities and private colleges that admit students based on legacy, based on family alumni, based on extracurricular activities, athletic abilities, and, all kinds of other things besides grades and SAT scores. And I think that at this point in our society, we do need to consider, the fact of the matter is, in K through 12, before you get to a university level, there is an uneven level in terms of the access to education on a class and race level.
Eric?
Well, and I think actually right there, Emily brings up an important point, and I think maybe this may be an even better way of dealing with the situation is looking really more seriously at a class-based affirmative action that essentially allows advantages to those who are economically disadvantaged regardless of race or ethnicity, because it seems like to me that's sort of addressing the root or sort of what the source of where we may think people's disadvantage comes from, not having you know, a family, a certain amount of family income or wealth. And I think that would be something that people would find considerably less objectionable, and that would serve people who are poor. Or,
but what about the fair? I mean, what about the fair playing field? As many of the advocates of affirmative action say, that there is not a fair playing field when it comes to college admissions, and University of Michigan has put itself, like many universities, in position. You can call it quotas if you want, or discrimination, but they put themselves in a position by those who are of not the majority, but of quote-unquote America's minority, may they be Latino, may they be African-American, Asians, any of those groups that are non-white, they're in a position where they can get also the same fair playing ground.
Well, the question, I'm kind of curious what these advocates think of as an unfair playing field, because at least one of the minorities you've mentioned, I've never actually heard of an affirmative action case dealing with an Asian minority.
Well, they are. There are definitely some that came out, and that's the reason why Asian American groups are strongly protesting this whole thing. They're in support of the affirmative action program at University of Michigan.
Well, which is very odd, because in places like California, Asians are discriminated against because of racial preferences. There are too many ideal of the folks supporting affirmative action. There are too many Asians applying, and so they actually stamp down on Asian admissions in order to admit other minorities. And I think it's a slippery slope between choosing
Jim kind of leads to the bigger question, which is, what is a fair playing field? Is a fair playing field an admissions system that accepts everyone based on, you know, the quality of contribution you're going to make to the university?
Many minorities feel that they are not accepted regardless of their qualifications. Many without affirmative action programs, many feel that this only opens the door to more discrimination.
And I think that as long as we have an uneven playing field leading up to the university level, until we have a nationalized education system before the university level, you're going to have inequitabilities in terms of the opportunities that people have in a lower level of education, because of the education is tied exactly to property taxes, real estate values, and historically, real estate values are attached to racial majorities in that area.
The whole census breakdown.
It's always a privilege in terms of being able to afford a certain amount of education and being able to get to the opportunity in a university level.
But we don't admit people based on what opportunity you had. We admit people based on what opportunity you took advantage of.
Access to a certain opportunity before you get to the university level because of the area that you grew up in, which is often tied to your racial background, then you may not have the opportunity to get to, you know, to show that at a university level.
Hold it, Jim. Just want to remind everybody they can join in. 301-230-0980, #980 on Verizon Wireless System. Absolutely free call. Jim Parmalee, the Republican.
All this talk that's coming about all these advantages and disadvantages. Look, I graduated from the D.C. public schools, and I can tell you, the school system is mostly African American.
Not when you graduated.
Yeah.
I was?
At 85?
Oh, 85.
Oh, yeah. 85,
young,
yeah, absolutely.
Young man.
Yeah. And let me tell you, every student that studied, that got good grades, had the opportunity to go to college. I didn't know of any that didn't have the opportunity to go to college and didn't have the opportunity to get scholarships. So I think, you know, everybody had an opportunity. The question is who takes the opportunity, and that doesn't depend on your race or your gender or anything else.
Yeah,
that depends on your drive.
But Jim, the argument could be that many do take the opportunity and they're still discriminated against.
Well, that's wrong, too.
Wait a minute, especially if you're a minority. I mean, it's very difficult for us to say how many minority kids have suffered because there was no affirmative action.
But how
program.
Does affirmative action fix that?
Well,
if you get discriminated against, Jerry, how does me taking someone else who's of the same racial group and letting them in preference to a third person who may be better qualified for that seat.
No, fix, but you see,
how is that redress for what you,
yeah,
what happened to you?
See, that's where the misconception of affirmative action falls. When you say that less qualified, the persons that are entering many of these schools are not under affirmative action programs are not less qualified, number one. And number two, affirmative action really didn't help many African Americans in this country as much as white women.
Well, I think that I'll be the first to agree that affirmative action isn't in practice. Isn't in practice what it should be in theory. I mean, in theory, historically, when you had a candidate or a male candidate and a female candidate presented before a job or a university that had the same qualifications, the white male was chosen first because those making the decisions were white males, and there was felt to be, you know, that there isn't a color or gender blindness there. And the idea behind affirmative action is that when those equal candidates are presented, that the minority or the female is going to be chosen to even the playing field. And so, of course, you know, that doesn't always happen in practice, but the idea is that you don't go with someone with lesser qualifications. You go with people that have the same qualifications, but rule in favor of those who historically would not have been chosen.
Our telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980, the Verizon wireless system. If we happen to move on to another topic, you can still call and talk about the last topic. We don't mind because we have a very intelligent group here, and they can remember the last topic we talked about, not necessarily the next topic that we're going to. Now, having said that, we have on the panel this morning
Nick Starwark, the Libertarian.
Jim Parmley, Republican.
Emily Leffler, Independent.
Eric Michelson, Green.
Thank you very much. And Dana Jones, the Democrat, is out to lunch.
She didn't set her watch for
she didn't set her watch.
She's waking up right now.
Is that any indication of the Democrats in the next presidential? They're kind of late on things.
A day late and a dollar short.
Before we go to the next topic, I must share with you a letter that we got from the last, an email that we got from the last roundtable discussion when we got into the politics of the next elections to come. And this gentleman who wrote, his name is Randy Ash. He simply sent us a little email, and I'm quoting. He's from Manassas, Virginia. "Well, you're at it again, aren't you, Jerry?" "Was listening to your roundtable discussion." He's speaking of the one in March. "Listening to your roundtable discussion this morning and had to turn it off. You were in seventh heaven with so many administration bashers on your show. I know you always say that it is balanced. Don't think so. I know you had one Republican on with a representative from the other parties, and that amounted to six or seven against one with the type of people calling in." Now, I mean, this guy is really off the edge. Number one, most of the calls, if you remember, and we can go back and document, we have the documentation of it, most of the calls calling in did not agree necessarily with Bush on his stand in the war in Iraq.
Amazing.
And the panel here, they're not all Democrats. Everybody, that's the purpose of this panel. You can't get any more balanced, Mr. Ash, than to have a Republican, a Democrat, a Green Party, a Libertarian, and an Independent. And how much more balanced? But we do appreciate your letter. And if you're listening, give us a call because we'd love to talk with you. Yes.
And Jerry, let me point out, I've had comments like that, too. People say, "Well, hold it, Jim, you're outnumbered 4-1 on the war on this show." And I say, you know, it does break down by party. And when we had the sales tax referendum last fall, it was 3-1 against the referendum because you had the Libertarians and the Green Party folks against the sales tax as well as the Republicans. So I think it does depend on issue. The show is very balanced. Yeah. On the war, though, I am outnumbered 4-1.
Right. Well, I mean,
on this show, yeah, I do have 70%
of today.
I have 70% of the American people behind me. But
no,
I'm not
come
number
on.
4-1.
Yeah, you have 70% behind the truth.
These are the representatives of the American people. No one's putting thoughts in these people's minds.
Well, no.
And not only that, Jim Parmley, let me tell you, Mr. Republican, your polls don't show me very much when you talk about 70%. I have not. And I meet a lot of people. I talk to a lot of people. I have only found about four people that say they're in support of the war. Now, I'll get off. Emily, you have something to say?
It's interesting.
Oh, let's go on to the next issue then. Ron in D.C., good morning. How you doing?
Good morning, Jerry. You have an excellent show.
Thank you.
I am a Democrat also, but let me throw in this point about the affirmative action process. As a black male who is from D.C. public schools, graduated from in 1976, and went to a all-white college, I think, which is Villanova. I think even though you get into and out of the process, you have to have it until, as the young lady said before, something is remedied in our system. Even though you get out of that process, I think any young black male who participates in the workforce better go into the workforce understanding that, and not in a negative way, but understanding that he must be able to compete and be the best or with his white male counterpart, black female counterpart, and white female counterpart to get ahead in our society. So until we really remedy the process, I don't know what it's going to take, and it may be another 100 years before we get to that point, we're going to continue to have this problem.
So in other words, on a colorblind society, you would need affirmative action.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ron. Anybody want to answer to that as we move on? Okay, let's talk to Stuart in South Riding, Virginia. Where is South Riding, Virginia?
Loudoun County.
Loudoun County, okay. Go right ahead, Stu.
Thank you very much for the opportunity this morning. Good morning, everyone.
Thanks for joining us.
Two quick points, if I may. Affirmative action, in theory, I agree, is a wonderful concept. Now, being a white male, being the child of two city, inner city parents, neither of whom were able to go to college because they couldn't afford it, they provided the opportunity for me to proceed in my education, which I had to work for and pay for, and I proceeded through a master's degree and through a doctorate degree. My point being, along the way, I was told that, I'm sorry, we, this large major telecommunications firm, cannot hire you because, in fact, we've mistaken affirmative action for a quota system, and we cannot hire a white male at this point in time. So that's obviously an example of the system gone wrong.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that has been the problem.
And it has
certainly, geared away from what the meaning of affirmative action is in any application.
Well, no, that is the meaning of affirmative action. That's exactly what Emily was talking
about. No, that's not the meaning of affirmative action.
Let me finish.
That's not what I was saying.
What you were talking about was there is a bias in a hiring process to hire the person that's like you. So by shifting the bias to hire the person that's unlike you, you level the play. Really is the same as, say, for example, that the hirer, say that, let's take it for a second, black females were the majority of hirers throughout this society, and they discriminated and mostly hired black females. Would it be fair to make all the black females hire more white males and really discriminate on the other side to even the playing field?
Well, you can shift it any way you want. The point is that it's not, affirmative action doesn't say, hey, let's take the first 20 blacks that come through the door and then we can start hiring some whites. The idea behind affirmative action is, okay, we have Jim from Loudoun County, or was it Jim or Dan?
No, it was Stuart.
We have Stuart from Loudoun County, and we have his neighbor down the street, a black female, and both folks went to college. Both folks have a master's or a doctorate or, you know, that sort of thing. All right, you know, they would be equally suited to do this job. In this case, we will choose the black female. The white male would have gotten the job. That's the ideal scenario. I realize that. There are a lot of flaws in affirmative action.
That's not ideal, though. What if the same person doing the hiring said, both of you are equally qualified for the job, but I like the white guy? That's horrifying, and that's wrong.
Yeah, but you know what? We still find a better solution.
Let's go eliminate race from those sorts of things.
Eliminate race.
Okay, Mr. Republican, let's see what happens.
The federal government is do that in all areas except affirmative action, where they enforce it.
And I can see that doing that heartily.
Certainly the Census Bureau is one of the, I mean, that communication of races has gotten really absurd, even from those that signed the other line on the dock. Stuart in Virginia, South Riding. Stuart, come on, ride through again.
Yeah, one more quick point, Jerry, and I'm sorry, I'm going to take a quick zing at you.
Okay. That's okay. I get it all the time, buddy. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, we love the show, though. I'm up every Sunday morning with you.
Thank you.
But, you know, I'm a registered Democrat, and I had some reservation about the initiation of the war, but I do support what we're doing now to get the job done.
Yeah.
One comment that you made, and this may have been a slip, but you referred to President Bush as Bush.
Everybody refers to him as Bush.
Well, I think the title and the position of the office that he holds in this country earns him the right to at least be addressed as Mr. Bush or President Bush.
Stuart, Jim Parmelee loves you. He's sitting up here just going, shaking his finger at me.
Parmelee's silent majority.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stuart. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Right. He has a point. We should call the President Bush. But when you're speaking in text, it is perfectly okay to address a person by their last name, as long as I don't go around saying, Georgie boy. Moving on to the next topic. Who should restore Iraq after the war? The United Nations, Germany, France, the U.S., or Great Britain? And there is a conflict between Great Britain and the U.S. on this.
Hey, I have an idea that's not on the list, Jerry. How about Iraqis?
Iraqis.
I know. It's wacky. I've heard of this country that we invaded, that maybe they should restore their own country. I know.
But then they might not want us to give us the oil.
My question is, who's best at restoring Iraq? I'm trying to reiterate. Eric, help me out here.
Yeah, I'll try to help you out, Jerry. If the question is truly who's best at restoring Iraq, I'm going to have to defer to, I think, to Nick's philosophy here and say, well, let's open it up to the free market and let the, let independent bids come in from where they may, whether it be France or China or the U.S. or Britain, and let's see who can best serve the Iraqis in payment with the Iraqi oil rather than going in and dictating who...
Jim Parmelee?
Well, look, I think the Iraqis in the end are going to restore democracy to them like we've been restoring it to Afghanistan and so on, and it certainly takes more than a few weeks to restore democracy to a country. But let's make it clear, the Iraqis didn't liberate themselves. We did. And we're stepping in. I'll repeat that. The Iraqis did not liberate themselves. We did.
We killed 100,000 in the news.
We didn't kill 100,000. Show me this. Show me where we killed 100,000 Iraqis.
News copy.
And if we've killed 100,000 Iraqi soldiers, that's perfectly okay.
Command says between 2,000 and 3,000 Iraqis. Doesn't say soldiers. Iraqis were killed when American troops moved through Baghdad yesterday.
Those would be soldiers.
AP, Associated Press.
I'll tell you, if you're pointing a gun at an American tank, then certain things are going to happen to you. We're stepping in there. We're stepping. There have been unfortunately civilian casualties, but they are the lowest amount of civilian casualties in any conflict that any of us can possibly think of.
Nicholas, let me ask you a question based on this. Let's get back to the point here. Who's going to restore the Iraqi government? Should it be the United Nations? Should it be the U.S. or Great Britain? Great Britain says they don't like the plan that Mr. Bush, that his administration has, especially sending Shell Oil in to control the oil fields after the restoration goes into effect.
Well, I thought Halliburton would do better at that. it really should be done. It should be done by the Iraqis, and since the Iraqis don't seem to have the ability to stand up to us in that regard, I would say probably the United Nations would be the best way to go. But it's interesting to note that our Latin American coalition members, and I use the term advisedly, the reason they're part of the coalition is they've had democracy restored to them before numerous times and with military force, and they just want to stay low. Just stay low.
I don't know. There was restoration not in South America. But anyway, I'll telephone number 301-230-0980, pound 980 in Verizon. I'd like to hear from you as to what you think. Should America come about with the restoration and forming control over the Iraqi people? Or should it be from the United Nations, or should it be the Iraqis themselves?
Let me point out, Eric. America is spending a lot of money, a lot of lives, and a lot of effort in freeing the Iraqi people. And we're going to go in there, and we're going to reestablish democracy.
Is that the purpose?
Yeah, the people around the world seem to have a hard time believing that we're in there to disarm the country restore democracy because other countries don't do that. I mean, unlike France that still occupies colonies, we are freeing this country. And I think the oil should be used for restoring Iraq.
Excuse me, people in the District of Columbia, it's not a colony.
Talk to the true colleges around the world and see how they're treated.
Jerry, you know, the notion that obviously that Nick alluded to earlier, that democracy was restored to certain Central and Latin American countries, is ridiculous on its face. But let's even discuss a more recent example, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy has been restored to about two blocks of Kabul, as far as I understand. And in fact, most of the country is being run by the warlords who were raping and pillaging.
Different. Would you rather have the Taliban back?
I'm speaking, Jim. In fact, these people were running the country, and they were running it in such a poor fashion that it actually created popular support when the Taliban did come around. So, you know, to be having the country in the hands of these Northern Alliance folks is not going to bode well for us in the future.
If you're just joining us, it's the first Sunday roundtable, our political roundtable debate, and we love it every first Sunday because people like to share out the ideas, and I think it's great. At least we have a very balanced roundtable, representatives from the various parties, and an independent. And there's some things that maybe the roundtable may stack up against Jim Pomeroy, the Republican. But the Republicans have full control. They call it the regime, is it? Anyway, they have full control of the American government right now. Emily Loeffler is the independent. Jim Pomeroy is the Republican. Dana Jones, the Democrat, is out hiding, looking for votes. Eric Nicholson, Green Party, and Nicholas Sawalk, the Libertarian. There you go. So when it comes down to restoration in Iraq, how many agree that it should be the American government, the Pentagon, should take control? How many? Just say yes. People can't see
I'm guessing
hand.
Just me.
I see one lonely hand.
One lonely hand.
It's a lot of guns in it.
Because with the entire U.S. Army behind me. Because Mr. Ash writing me again. All right, the next question. What about the fact that Great Britain feels the United Nations should take control? How many agree with that?
Well, perhaps they don't want to spend their tax dollars on it. Big surprise.
Typical of the British. Anyway, moving along. How many feel that the United Nations should take control? I'd ask that question. Nobody. How many feel that the Iraqi people should take control?
Let's look at how good, I mean, the United Nations has done at taking control of countries. I think the longest standing UN mission now is Cyprus, where they still hate each other. And it's been, I think, well over 30, we're pushing on 40 years now the UN's been there, and nothing has happened for reunification. So, well, maybe they shouldn't take control either.
301-230-0980, round 980 in the Verizon Wireless System over in Laurel, Maryland. Good morning, Joan.
Hi. I just wanted to say, somebody there said something about restoring democracy. I don't think Iraq has ever had a democracy. And therefore, you can't restore something that hasn't been. And I don't know that we can ever put in our form of democracy. I mean, I think it's up to the Iraqi people.
You know, she raises a very... Turn your radio down, Lydia.
It's off.
She raises a very interesting... What is that? Maybe you take her pot down a little bit. There you go. I think she raises a very interesting question here, Jim Pomeroy, because you were the one who brought this up. And I was talking to some people the other day from Iraqi American Council, and they were saying, you know, you have to understand that in that part of the country, democracy could be very easily defined differently, because what we know as in our society as a form of democracy may not be the same to everybody around the world. So I think Joan raises a very good question. Eric, and then I'll go to Nicholas.
Well, you bring up a really good point. I was speaking with an Arab American gentleman who runs an organization called the Mideast Peace Project, and he was bringing up exactly that point. I mean, the issue is that democracy is really a process. If you look at the evolution of democracy in the U.S., I mean, it came from hundreds of years of experience in Europe, and it was something that people were ready for at this point. It's not something necessarily that can just be easily imposed on individuals who've been ruled autocratically for hundreds or thousands of years. And so I think that, you know, there has to be an understanding of the nuance and the complexities of it.
Joan, what did you have in mind? Oh, I'm sorry, Nicholas. I stepped on Nicholas. Well, Joan, hold your point. Nicholas.
Well, I just wanted to... I mean, Joan brings up a good point, although it's interesting. Iraq is actually the only country in the Arab world with any form of democracy. that was before we came in. They're the only ones that actually give any sort of lip service to elections, and they're also the only secular country in the region. And to stop fundamentalist Islamic terrorism, we've bombed the only secular country in the Arab world.
Well, Turkey is. I mean, they've
Turkey's not considered the Arab world.
Yeah, Turkey doesn't have oil either. Joan? Joan's gone? Let's talk to Ken in D.C. Good morning, Ken.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
This is sort of a comment and a question. Of course, democracy is possible in Iraq, but the question is, will it take 50 years to achieve that? So for me, it's a question of how long the commitment is to maintaining a presence and support for a process that could take 50 years to achieve.
Okay.
Well, I think that, you know, when you're looking, let's look at the main reason for going in there. The main reason for going in there is because Saddam Hussein was a threat by supporting terrorism around the world. So
according
that's objective.
According to the Bush administration, he's a threat.
Well, I mean, he's vocalized repeatedly that that he backs terrorist movements around the world. So so that's the number one objective, and that objective is going to be obtained. The second objective is to free the Iraqi people. That is going to be obtained.
Mm-hmm.
The third objective is to restore or to install, depending on how you look at their history, democracy. And, you know, that is something that is going to take the Iraqi people. But I think that they want democracy. When given a choice, people around the world choose democracy.
The American democracy.
But they choose
the
democracy,
American
period. Well, it originally came from Athens. So, I mean, if you want to, you know, go back in history, but they choose democracy.
Okay, Eric. So, Jim, then I guess you would say that you don't support our government support of the Saudi regime, which has actively worked against democratic reforms in that country.
I support them becoming more democratic. I support the efforts of Pakistan to become more democratic. And they are currently, I mean, with their legislature and so on, in all of these Arab countries and Muslim countries, I support democracy in all of them.
Okay, Ken, is that satisfactory to you?
Well,
I don't know that I'm comfortable with the idea that the democracy that we're talking about achieving, from my point of view, I'm not sure how successful we have been at bringing along all of our citizens into the concept of democracy. So my struggle is with the idea that we can impose something that we have difficulty passing along to our children who are graduating from schools every year.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken, for your input.
I want to respond to Ken's point about the question of what sort of commitment do we have to really establishing democracy there. And I just wanted to respond with a quick question. Does anyone know who currently runs Kosovo? Can anyone name the leader there? Remember then we were going to... Yeah.
Unlike Oprah Winfrey, who said when we were...
We've got short memories here.
We don't have to remember the names of the leaders.
Unlike Oprah Winfrey, who said when we were in Afghanistan, this is the first time we came spelling. That's a new word in our vocabulary. I love that line. I'll never forget that. I'm not saying it right, but that's what she...
I mean, as long as they are... I'll tell you, in Kosovo, at least they're not killing each other to the degree that they were before, and they're more democratic now than they were before. So I think, you know, and that is something that we've left... the large parts of the U.S.
The U.S. Yeah.
We'll have to see whether that works or not.
Emily?
Well, Jerry, I think our caller made a good point as well in terms of looking at our own democracy in another country and how long this could go on to, quote-unquote, restore democracy in Iraq. If it could mean spending billions of dollars and having troops there for years and years and years. We started off this show talking about affirmative action, about how level the playing field is in our own country. In today's post, there was an editorial by a resident of Adams Morgan who said, hey, can we throw some of that money our way and get some of the children that are carrying guns to school in the inner city of the District of Columbia to, you know, take care of that program. Let's disarm our teenagers. You know, we have enough problems in our own country trying to keep democracy and equal opportunity alive that, you know, to go and throw billions of dollars away. country where they may or may not want our form of democracy.
You stepped on the Republicans' toe.
There couldn't be any private guns in D.C. It's against the law to have any private weapons in D.C. And we all know control works, doesn't it, everybody?
Yes, it works if we can stop bringing them in from Virginia and Maryland where they can buy them.
And if perhaps the federal...
Hey, I went to the D.C. public schools. I know about guns.
Moving along, folks, to the next topic on the agenda here. I mean, you know, America, everything relates to us. Gun control and affirmative action. Anyway, will the ramifications and the effects of the war on the upcoming presidential elections next year have an effect?
Yeah, it depends on whether or not we bomb something else. If we're still fighting a war, then Bush will probably win. If he can pull it out, if he learns from his father that the war has to be continued up through the election, you can't stop. Because if you stop, people start thinking about domestic issues. He can keep it going up through the election. I think he's got a good chance to win again.
Eric?
I agree with Nicholas. The war as distraction worked in 2002, and, you know, maybe it can work again in 2004 for the Republicans if they can draw
it out. Interesting article in WashingtonPost.com. Or Bush, yesterday's paper. Time to mend. Economy is running out. And does that answer to you, Mr. Nicholas?
Yeah.
If the war continues up until the elections, he's in.
He's in.
But if you can't put bread on your table, then what, Jim?
He's
Connelly?
Out. I think he's in regardless. Hopefully, guys, you know, look at this. We've gone in. We have huge support for this war, and obviously, President Bush's father
had
support
after the war, after it started,
and
not
what
beforehand.
Happened. Yes, unfortunately, the last President Bush got suckered into a tax increase by the Democrats, and the economy tanked.
Well, he wanted
and
a tax.
They got him. They got him to break his no tax promise, and that's why he lost.
Personal responsibility,
and it has destroyed the economy.
But isn't
and
it true?
Look at the current President Bush has learned from past mistakes. And is cutting taxes and restoring our economy and restoring democracy in Iraq.
Restoring our economy.
But don't you think that a lot of
a lot of restoration.
Don't you think a lot of the support for this war, which all of us are very much 100% behind the troops, the men, the women that are over there fighting, people are behind that. And that has been interpreted by a lot of people as support for the war. There are a lot of people who don't support the war, but they support the troops.
But before the war started,
there was no support.
We sat here the last month on this show. I had the poll in front of me from the liberal media. It was not a poll by the Republican Party. It was a poll by. And a poll by ABC News, 63% of the American public supported going to war and supported President Bush.
What do you mean the liberal media?
The liberal media. Everybody except the Fox News Channel. And
and perhaps the fine folks
at Clear Channel.
The Washington Times is a fine liberal publication.
Fox News is owned by a guy who lives in Australia. Moving along.
God bless Australia.
Yeah. Talk to the Bush people about that.
I just want to remind Jim of personal responsibility. President Bush, the senior, didn't get suckered into voting for a tax increase. He did it because he's a Republican.
Our telephone number, your own fault. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get into it, some of those folks, I know that you might be wondering what we're doing, but it's our first Sunday roundtable, political roundtable. And one of the things I like about this roundtable, it's not because it's only on Metropod, but one of the things I like about it is the fact that we address the issues, I think, the way a lot of people do on the street. I mean, you have to kind of laugh at times, you know, as we talk about serious things, because otherwise we will become a very dismal society. And you talk to a lot of psychologists, and a lot of people are very worried about what children are seeing on television, and many of us as adults, watching on television constantly. War is not a fun thing. And yes, we have to know about it. But when we can sit here at a round table and debate and still share with each other a little laughter, you know, it does make the world a better place. I just wanted to say that. Now that I'm off my soapbox, I'll move on. 301-230-0980, #980, and Verizon Wireless System. Our lines are open if you have comments on any of the issues that we've just been discussing. With us, of course, we have our independent, Emily Leffler, along with Jim Pomeroy, a Republican. Dana Jones, Democrat, is missing in action. And Eric Mickelson, Green Party, and Libertarian Nicholas Sawalk is with us. Let's turn to local politics, guys. The local politics. Governor Robert Ehrlich lost his round this time last week, as the slot machines in Maryland will not necessarily be operating. The General Assembly Committee passed said that they would not go, and this is the second loss. Not only the slot machines, but also his environmental appointee was also on the General Assembly. Plus, he lost the fight for tax cuts instead of tax increases.
Well, he hasn't lost the fight for tax increases, fight against tax increases just yet. He says he's going to veto tax increases,
but he's been
and that's a good thing.
And wasn't he flip-flopped on that? Because at first he said no tax increases. Then he said we're going to have property tax increase.
Well, the Democrats are trying to, some Democrats, this doesn't necessarily break down partisanly, it breaks down pro-slots, anti-slots. The anti-slots folks were trying to extort him by saying we'll only vote for slots if we get taxes too, proving that they're tax and spend liberals regardless. They're willing to trade their principles on slots for a tax hike. And Governor Ehrlich thought about going along with them to get the slots, but in the end, he's standing firm against taxes.
Eric, is he having a hard time in Maryland with the General Assembly?
He is having a hard time with the General Assembly. Let me speak to Jim's issue. The main opponent of the slots, regardless of my own feelings about the slots, has been Mike Bush, head of the House of Delegates, all along. And as far as I know, he has not flip-flopped on the issue. There may have been people in the rank and file who have, but he has been firmly against this the entire time, when in fact, the county where I'm from, Anne Arundel County, a number of Republicans said when they ran for office, they said they were going to oppose slots. One of them joined the No Slots Coalition, and now he's in favor of slots because, I don't know if he got his arm twisted by the party officials or whatnot. So, again, like you said, it's not breaking down across party lines, but I think that there is a deep division over this issue.
Emily, if it comes back to the table, you think he'll win next year on getting his slots machine measure through?
Well, I think there's already a strong enough opposition. I think it's obvious that in terms of the taxes, the money is needed elsewhere. And even the University of Maryland system, they're cutting funds. They're talking about having to cut courses, basic student services.
Based on the latest article, now that the slot machines did not go through, he's also, made a great threat on the, $5 billion deficit? And now, yesterday's morning's paper was saying that more higher education funding in Maryland will be cut.
We're not talking about actual cuts. What we're talking about budget from last year. We should really do government budgets like we do our own budgets. If you have a certain amount of money this year, and next year you were expecting to get a 10% raise, but you only get a 5% raise, we don't go around complaining that our budget was cut. We say we didn't get the same raise we wanted. We're only talking about lowering the raises. We're not talking about cutting
anything. No, we're not talking about lowering the raises. We're talking about actually cutting courses and cutting basic services.
Cutting courses, but not funding.
The money that funds the courses.
Jim, down in Centerville, Virginia, help us out. How are you doing, Jim?
Good, thank you. I'd just like to comment on the war and on these people that say I support the troops but I don't support the war. That's just a bunch of hogwash. It's kind of like telling your child that I support you getting married but I don't like your wife or your husband.
That happened a lot of times.
And I've been a soldier. I was a soldier during Vietnam and I was a soldier during the first Gulf War. And when you're out there on the battlefield and you see the demonstrators and the people doing what they're doing, and you hear them say, I support the troops, you don't believe it for a second.
I want to thank Jim for his service to our country, but respectfully disagree. The troops are sent over there by the president and sometimes the Congress, although sometimes they abdicate that responsibility. And to not support the president, a civilian, sending them over is very different than supporting the troops who are there. I actually have family in the military, and I really do support the troops. I would actually support supporting the troops by bringing them home. But it's perfectly and 100% American and has been done in every single conflict in American history to oppose the war even while there are troops overseas. You oppose the war, you don't oppose the troops. What was done in Vietnam was despicable, that you would allow soldiers to come home and actually attack soldiers for doing the job that they had to do because of the oath they took when they entered service. So I have to disagree with the caller.
Okay.
Well, You know, so we're here in the same studio that with a big picture of G. Gordon Liddy, so I have to remind me to say thank you.
It has nothing to do with Metro Talk.
Right. the other studio
has nothing to do with Mr. Liddy, nice guy. Well, whatever you mean. Has nothing to do with Metro Talk. Please don't go there. Okay?
Anyway, I'd say it anyway.
We just happen to be in the studio. All right.
But thank you for your service to our country, and I agree with him completely, and we need more callers like this gentleman here. But
well,
let me tell you.
Because you're a Republican. What do you expect?
Because his name's Jim.
His name is Jim.
He's a Republican from Virginia. God bless you, sir. You know, I'll tell you what. There have been people at these answer rallies, these anti-war answer rallies, who have they had a banner up that said, "We support our troops as long as they're shooting their officers," and that sort of thing. And it's a photo that's been going around. It's horrible. And a lot of the speakers at these rallies are truly anti-American. And there are a lot of patriotic Americans who oppose the war, and I understand that, and they have a right to their views. But the core leadership of the anti-war movement
is the answer
movement. If you go to their website and you look at the sponsoring organizations, a number of them are groups that truly disagree with our form of government.
Some might be, don't you think, panel? But not all. I mean, you got
to...
Jesse Jackson is the loudest with the most money and the most people to organize rallies. They're not the core leadership.
I'll take that. The people with the most money and the most organization to run these rallies is anti-American. I agree with you.
But that's not the majority of Americans that are against the war.
I did not say that. I'm saying the organizers.
While you guys try to figure that out, let's talk to Garland on the cell phone. Thanks, Garland, for waiting.
Hi. Two reasons why I think our argument that we want democracy in the Middle East is pretty weak. And I'll leave you with a quote. The first reason is this. Oddly enough, Iraq is one of the few countries that is run by the minority. Iraq is 6% Shiite Muslims who are strongly associated with Iran. The rest are divided between Kurds and Sunni Muslims, et cetera, et cetera. So if we put a democracy in Iraq that is one man, one vote, well, hopefully one man and one woman, the Shiites will win every seat. And the first thing they will say is, get the heck out, we're one big Iran. That's number one. Number two, if in fact there was a democracy in Jordan and Egypt right now, they would declare war on the United States. Because the president, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, the king of Jordan, are both acquiescing to their people who are absolutely enraged with us, and they are condemning the war and they are condemning the United States. If there was a representative government in both of those countries, they'd declare war on us. Furthermore,
not unless they were suicidal.
So thrilled with us either. If you get a representative government in Saudi Arabia right now, they wouldn't sell us a drop of oil. Our argument for democracy in the Middle East would destroy us right now because the people hate our guts.
Okay,
so
Garland.
How are we arguing that we want democracy in the Middle East?
Garland, can you hold on the line?
Certainly.
Don't leave, okay? We got other people that we want to get on the line with you. Yes, Jim.
Let me tell you, if we had more democracy in the Middle East, and they are liberalizing a lot of their policies, but the democracy is good,
liberal?
Even if they agree with us. Liberal in that context, and that they are opening up to more democracy, and that's a good thing because democratic societies don't go to war against each other, and democratic societies will sell oil and other products to
anybody who will pay.
Well, I think our caller makes an interesting point in that our moral imperative to bring democracy to Iraq is a very convenient and selective thing. For example, we have no problem with Turkey oppressing the Kurds in eastern Turkey for decades and torturing them, allowing them to have a democratic say in their ruling, because Turkey is someone we'd like to consider a friend, so we're not going to tell them how to run their country.
Well, right. They also have the PKK blowing up stuff in Ankara.
Let's talk with Robert, my good buddy down in Sterling. Garland, don't leave. I need your help on this one. Robert is on the line with Garland. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Jerry.
My good buddy.
Thanks for taking my call again.
You got 60 seconds.
Well, I just wanted to know what the Democrats' version to slots in Maryland was. I'm not real clear on that issue. Is it a moral issue?
Well, it wasn't all the Democrats, because Mike Steele, who is a Democrat, was very much
Republican.
I'm sorry. He was supportive of the slot machines, right.
Yeah. So what is the problem? Are they morally averse to slots? Is that it?
But it wasn't all the Democrats, because there were some Democrats supporting the slots machines overall. It was a moral issue because it was churches,
you had a lot of churches against it. They were organizing particularly black churches against it because slots take from a lower income demographic, and that's what the Democrats and the Speaker were going after. So, I don't think it necessarily breaks down partisanly.
Okay. Donald, thank you very much. Robert? He's gone, too. Okay. Mark in Springfield. Good morning, Mark. You got about 10 seconds.
Less than that. I think what I'm hearing this morning, and I had to laugh, was we support our demonstrators. We just don't support the organizers. Thanks.
That's like I don't support the demonstrators, but I'm not calling them anti-American. I support
thank
free speech,
much,
but the organizers of the anti-war movement are by and large anti-American.
Jim Popley, the Republican, thank you. Eric Mickelson, Green Party, and Nicholas Sawalk, Libertarian. And if you'd like to continue this, call us in our public affairs office, 301-230-3582. Call over there, and these guys will argue with you on the telephone. I want to thank those who helped to put it together, our technical style producers, Steve Solomon, Courtney Lane, our administrator, Quentin Jackson, public affairs assistant, simulcast operator, Paula Casey. Written and produced by yours truly, Jerry Phillips, Metro Talk is a WBIG, WTEM public affairs presentation from Clear Channel Radio in good old Washington, D.C. Till next time, my friend, much peace, much love. W-B-I-G.